Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Farm Report, where we talk about the nitty-gritty of agriculture and food production each week. I'm your host, Holly Cederholm, broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, I'm excited to have Lindsay Lusher-Shoot calling into the studio. Lindsay is a co-founder and the executive director of the National Young Farmers Coalition. NYFC represents, mobilizes, and engages young farmers to ensure their success by supporting practices and policies that will help them now and in the future. It was founded in 2010 and has since engaged tens of thousands of farmers in policy action, galvanized the land trust community around farmland affordability, and organized rural chapters across the country. Through her role as ED, Lindsay regularly keynotes at farmer conferences and is known as an expert on structural issues facing family farms. In 2014, she was named a champion of change by the White House. She is also a young farmer. Along with her husband, Ben Shute, she operates Hardy Roots Community Farm on 70 acres in Claremont, New York. Lindsay, welcome to the Farm Report.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So I'm very excited to have you on the show today to address some of the largest barriers facing our nation's future farmers. One significant obstacle facing youth in general is the burden of student loan debt. And then this becomes especially crippling when added to the capital investment that a farm requires to get it off the ground. So the National Young Farmers Coalition has been advocating for the passage of H.R. 2590, which is the Young Farmer Success Act of 2015. And this adds farming to a list of professions currently covered by the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So what would this look like in action?
The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program is an existing program that nonprofit employees, doctors, nurses, teachers can take advantage of, and it's intended to help encourage people to enter high-demand but low-paying careers, or low-paying at least, you know, at first. And so what we're advocating for is that full-time farmers are able to access this program like these other professions. And so if we were able to pass this legislation, then farmers working full-time on operations grossing more than $35,000 a year, so that's sort of a determination of, you know, what a full-time farmer is, and that, you know, cuts out sort of, you know, people who are farming part-time or, you know, more as a hobby. Like, you know, we're really looking to benefit full-time farmers. They would be able to be on an income contingent payment plan for 10 years, and if they hadn't paid off their loan at the end of 10 years, then they would be eligible for loan forgiveness.
And so who determines the $35,000 annual income as the status of a full-time farmer?
That's a great question, and it's something that would likely be worked out in the rulemaking. After the bill was passed, figuring out like what agency does what is something you know that would need to be worked out. Essentially, most farmers are filing a Schedule F with their taxes every year, and you know, on that form, it's clear, you know, what the gross sales are of a farm, and so that would make an individual farm qualified for its employees, whether that's the owner-operator or, you know, other, you know, a farm manager or farm worker, to qualify for this program.
Yes, I guess. But where did that number come from? Just thinking about it, I know
where did the 35,000 come from?
Yeah,
it's a good question, and we've gotten, you know, some people are like, well, the farm is grossing 35,000. You know, how on earth would somebody be making a living wage? And that's a really good question, very valid question. We were trying to set a threshold that's low enough that we're not excluding people who are getting going, who are, you know, working full time on a farm as an owner operator, and in their first few years, maybe, you know, they are grossing 35 or 45. They likely have an off farm job as well, but we wanted to be able to help those people count those first years, even though they might not be earning a lot, as part of, you know, make those years count towards their student loan forgiveness. There's a large set of farms in the United States that are more or less hobby farms, where those farms are grossing less than $10,000 a year. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, that type of farm, you know, has its place, but that the farms that this program would really be helping are, you know, young people in agriculture who are really pursuing it as a full-time career.
See, it's interesting to me because I'm coming at it from the other end, where $35,000 is a very meager living annually. It also seems like that could be kind of a high bar for certain farmers starting out, even if they're doing it full time. Or for a farmer, for instance, in that 10-year window in which they need to be filing their Schedule Fs and meeting that bar, if they have a crop failure during that year. So I was just curious, because in looking at the other professions that are currently covered in the forgiveness program, there is no salary requirement. There's other vetting options that come in, like they have to have, you know, their full-time status. I think it's 30 hours a week or more in one of these careers vetted by their place of business. So I thought it was interesting in looking at it that there is this requirement.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And I think that, you know, we are certainly open to sort of smart solutions as to, you know, how to limit, like, the group of individuals that might be qualified for this program, both in a way that's not so limiting that it's penalizing, you know, people who are just starting out or having, like, have a very bad year, a crop failure or something of that nature. Like, that's certainly not the not the intent.
Yeah.
but at the same time, isn't casting a net so wide that you have a lot of farmers that are really not pursuing it as a full-time profession, that they somehow would not be eligible for loan forgiveness. Because, you know, the more people that are included in any federal program, the higher cost of that program.
Yeah.
And, you know, the less palatable it is, you know, to Congress. So we are trying to just, you know, make a definition that is, you know, narrow yet broad enough to, you know, include individuals.
The population it's trying to target.
Yeah. But crop failure, that's a great example of something that, you know, we haven't, you know, necessarily worked out, but, you know, depending on the, you know, agency that's administering this program, if it was USDA, for instance, you know, maybe there's, you know, something in the event of crop failure that could be filed to say, you know, this is what happened in this year, and there would be some, like, verification process of some sort. But it's, you know, it's a starting place, and most, you know, we looked at our, you know, just the general USDA statistics on, you know, farm sales, and, you know, thinking about our membership, and, you know, just talking to people, and 35,000 just seemed like as a gross number for gross sales.
Yeah.
like a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, and in terms of the other kind of definitions for this, what is considered like an agricultural product? Is it anything that's produced on farm? Like, would a value-added product like cheese that's made out of the dairy you're producing, or tomato jam made out of your tomato crop, are those considered, or is it just straight up like raw products?
No, it could be any farm sales. So anything that you as a farmer are you know, selling off of your farm, whether you know it's a raw, if it's carrots or it's pickled carrots, you know, all of that, you know, counts towards your farm sales for the year. So if you were a dairy and selling ice cream, you know, that would still be counted towards your farm sales.
Yeah.
If you're doing strictly like value added, like produce, like you, products rather, you were, you know, an ice cream maker and not a dairy farmer, I don't think you would be included in the current definition of the program. But if you were a dairy farmer and also, you know, selling ice cream from your farm stand, that would all be, you know, included towards, you know, your sales.
Great. So in terms of, you said after, so 10 years is the time that under the current definition of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, you have to be enrolled in this, and then you're eligible for your loan forgiven. Because it's an income-based program, it's like they calculate based on some metric, based on where you live and all these other factors, I'm guessing. They calculate what you should be paying each month, and likely if you're on an income-based program seeking student loan forgiveness, you're not going to pay off your loan. And if it's a, you know, any of the average-sized loans that people are leaving undergraduate school with these days. So what, you said you're eligible for the loan forgiveness. What does, like, so you get your loan forgiven, or there are additional steps at the end of these 10 years?
So no, I'll just, for full transparency, I'll say that no one yet has received any forgiveness under this program. It's a very new program for any career. So actually sort of what the steps are to getting that forgiveness, I think the details is, you know, still being worked out. But the idea is, yes, after you've worked 10 years and have made on-time income-based payments for that entire 10-year period, then you would likely have to, you know, fill out some paperwork,
yeah,
and then would receive, you know, forgiveness, or, you know, the federal government would then be, you know, paying your loan servicer, which I think is, in the case of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, you actually have to move your loans to the federal government as your servicer, that the loans at that point would be forgiven.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's 2017, I think, was saying that, that it might be when it actually the first group of people enrolled in this program will be eligible. But so on the, so this is great. I mean, I'm very excited about this, and I'm excited that the details are getting hashed out. And so we've got the Young Farmer Success Act, which was introduced at the House last summer, I believe. So what is the timeline for this particular potential broadening of the forgiveness program to farmers?
Right. Well, so we introduced the bill in the House early summer of last year, and we have bipartisan support in the House, which is great. It also needs to be introduced in the Senate. We are working on getting Senate sponsors at this time, so hopefully it'll be introduced there as well. But really, this bill is a marker bill, which means that it wouldn't be passed on its own. It would be passed as part of a larger package of legislation, and that is the Higher Education Act, which hopefully is going to be debated. And I mean, it's hard to say whether it will pass this year, but, you know, and it's an election year. It's fairly likely that it would, you know, be something that was really taken up in 2017 with the new administration. But nonetheless, the idea is that it's introduced, the ideas are out there, you know, you have support from the committee, the education committee, the agricultural committee, and you're able to get this language inserted in the larger package of legislation. It's a similar strategy that we've used, for instance, with the Farm Bill. We introduced the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Opportunity Act We actually ended up introducing it two times before the last farm bill, and some of the provisions from that were then incorporated into the larger farm bill. So that's the same model for the Young Farmer Success Act, and that, you know, we want this like small bit of language to be put in the bigger bill.
Yeah. So in the meantime, it seems like there are some alternate, at least I've seen at least two alternate forgiveness models that are coming up, one in New York and one in Pennsylvania. Do you know anything about these?
Well, actually, yes. I know a little bit about the New York State program. In fact, one of our farmers in our network and also our operations manager was able to take advantage of the New York State program. And the first round of that forgiveness was last year, in 2015. And that program is essentially available for young people who have gone to school in New York State and are farming in New York State. So she was eligible for that program. And so, unfortunately, if you've gone to school out of state, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
And the Pennsylvania program, I don't actually know the status of that. I think it was introduced at one point, and then it lost funding, and okay. I don't know that it's currently active at this point.
Yeah, it seemed like, in looking briefly over the New York program, it seemed really great for, like you said, New York students who are residents of New York and who plan to be in New York. The interesting thing that I saw is that it seems like they forgive a portion of your loan each year that you're enrolled in the program, with sort of like this five-year expectancy of forgiveness, with a cap of like $10,000 per year to be a full allotment of $50,000 towards your loans, which seems there are pros and cons, I think, to all things, but that seemed really interesting that, like, you could, you know, commit to farming for a year and see your, you know, and you're not getting like crop failure or other things that could happen over this 10-year period that the other loan program is requiring. So I thought it was interesting to see these different models taking place.
Yes, I mean, the New York State model, and you know, for the farmer that I was talking about, it's worked great. I mean, her loans are forgiven. She doesn't have to worry about student debt. Whereas the federal sort of remedy that we're promoting to add farmers to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, those farmers are still going to be paying their loans for 10 years, which, you know, is, it's income-based, so assuming that it would be a manageable amount to pay. But, having a program like what's being introduced in New York State would be a lot more expensive on the federal level, of course. So,
yeah, that was one the cons that I was noting, is that it seemed like it's almost, the language seemed almost first come, first serve. And I don't know a lot about it, but it's just like, you know, we offer this, but it's, you know, pending applicants and the applicant pool. And it's almost too good to be true, except, you know, it is true for the people that take advantage of it in its early stages. So it's great to see that. And it's also, yeah, how do we have a model that is that the federal government will actually pass?
Yes, our goal is that we're able to, you know, to make paying back loans affordable for as many farmers as possible. And in, you know, states that are more progressive, like New York State, but also, you know, in Louisiana, you know, all over the country, where there's, you know, varying, interest in this type of policy, as well as just like public resources to pay for them. So, we're going the federal route just because it seems, I mean, that is clearly like the most scalable, and there's also, you know, already a precedent out there for these other careers.
So you mentioned, using the example of the New York program, you have to be a New York resident. In terms of the federal push in the Young Farmer Success Act, are there certain loans that are the only, like, are certain loans eligible for this, or is it all student loans, or how does that work?
My understanding of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program is that it does not cover like private loans that you may have taken out during school. So, like the I'm actually eligible for this program because I am a farmer, but I'm also working full time at the National Young Farmers Coalition. So I've gone ahead and enrolled myself in this Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, and I know I took out PLUS loans, and so I could include those in the program. But I know that there are other types of loans that people get when they're in school, and those loans, it's my understanding, are not included in the scope of that program at this time.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know as much about that just because I haven't looked into it specifically.
Yeah. Well, great. So it's time to take a short break. When we get back, we're going to dig into some more of the barriers facing young farmers on the land today.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
You've tuned into the Farm Report. Today we have Lindsay Shute from the National Young Farmers Coalition on the line, and we're discussing some of the biggest barriers facing young farmers today. Before the break, I said facing farmers on the land today, but one of the biggest challenges is land and land access. So what options do new farmers have for land tenure, and what are some of the inherent challenges?
That's a great question. Yeah, land is likely the most difficult challenge that most young and beginning farmers will face. And when I say land, I mean finding land that they can have for a long time, and that is affordable. So land that they can either buy outright or that they can rent and have a very long-term lease on, and are able to make capital improvements on, put in barns if they need to, or high tunnels for production, or a wash pack facility, whatever it might be.
Build up their soil.
What'd you say, Holly?
Build up their soil,
exactly. Having a place to, conduct business and have that place be affordable and secure is a major challenge. It's a major challenge in particular for farmers that are doing direct marketing, living, within a couple hundred miles of a major city. The land is very, very expensive, because there is pressure from non-farmers and the like, purchasing farms and outbidding an average farmer. So the way that we're seeing our farmers find land, many of them are renting land to begin with, which is not a bad thing to do. It's a great way for people to learn about farming if they haven't farmed in the past, to get their businesses going, to test out. Sometimes people grow vegetables to begin with, but then they decide they really love flower farming or livestock or whatever. So give some flexibility and some opportunity for change. But then at some point, farmers are looking for something more permanent, and so some farmers are able to negotiate a 20-year or 50-year lease on some properties. That is one option. It is quite difficult, however, to find a landowner willing to give a lease for that amount of time.
Yeah.
Some farmers are going out and buying land, figuring out how to do that. There are, you know, a variety of options for making that land more affordable. One of the options that Young Farmers Coalition talks a lot about is partnering with the land trust to put a conservation easement on that property at the same time, which reduces the value of the land. It also permanently protects the land from development, which is a good thing for farmers, at least.
So how does that look like with the conservation easement on the land? Like, what does that look like from both sides? Like, the landowner who might be currently holding it, and then the future, hopefully, farmer that's going to get it. Like, what are the pieces of that?
Right. So there are a couple different types of conservation easements out there. There's a traditional type of conservation easement, and that essentially restricts development on a given farm. So what happens is a land trust approaches a farmer approaches a land trust and says, you know, we want to conserve this land and protect it from development over the long term. And the farmer can either donate the added value of being essentially the development rights to the land trust, or the land trust purchases those development rights from the farmer. And then at that point, there's a written contract that says, this land can never be developed. And the farmer is either compensated for that in cash or, you know, with certain tax breaks, because they've made a significant charitable donation. So the other type of easement that we have really been promoting at Young Farmers Coalition is important because it ensures that land remains open and available for farming, but it also remains affordable to working farmers. And that's called a working farm easement. It's something that's used in the state of Vermont, state of Massachusetts, and increasingly actually all across the country. There are examples of it now here in New York State, which has been great to see. And in this type of conservation easement, the land is protected from development, and the land must be owned by a working farmer. So a working farmer who agrees to put this type of working farm easement on their land essentially says that when the land is ready to transition, they have to sell it to someone who's making more than 50% of their income through farming.
Yeah.
So back to that Schedule F that, you know, farmers, you know, have to sell it every year. It's the same thing. The person has to essentially verify that they are, you know, a real working farmer. If the farmer attempts to sell the land to someone who's not a farmer, then the land trust has the option to buy back the land and sell it to a qualified farmer.
And that's an instance where the farmer who was leasing land to jumpstart some of their enterprises would be eligible to buy a farm that had a working farm easement because they had been filing Schedule Fs, or would it not? Because what if someone wanted to start a farm? They wouldn't be eligible to buy that because they wouldn't have the background on their taxes.
Yes, you don't have to be an independent operator or owner-operator to qualify. You could be working on somebody else's farm and still be making a significant portion of your income in farming. That's really sort of the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter if your name is on the schedule or not. It's just that you have to have, you know, been farming for a certain amount of time and intend to farm, you know, this property. The land trust has the option to review the qualifications of the person who, the new buyer of the land, to, you know, ensure that they will be really farming this land as was intended by the original easement.
Yeah. And so who are some of the partners that you've been working with on negotiating more of these conservation easements, or just tell me more.
Sure, yeah. So we did a survey in 2012, we released it, and put out a report called Conservation 2.0, Farmland Conservation 2.0. And this is all about how a traditional conservation easement doesn't go far enough. And we're seeing, you know, land that was conserved with public money that is essentially being purchased by non-farmers and then not really kept in production. And you know, people are contributing to land trusts and they're paying tax dollars in support of programs that are supposed to protect farms and so and farmland and active farms. Like that's what everyone wants to see. Everyone wants food and everyone wants, you know, vital and vibrant local economies, which
yeah.
farm support. So we were basically saying in that report that, you know, traditional conservation isn't going far enough. And we found from our survey of about 200 land trusts that about a quarter of them had seen protected land go out of production because it was purchased by a non-farmer. So this working farm easement really tackles that issue specifically. But at that time, very, very few land trusts nationally were using these types of conservation easements. So what we've done is a couple of things. We have both worked to ensure that there's federal money available for these types of conservation easements across the board, and we have also been holding professional development trainings for land trusts all across the country to teach them how to use these working farm easements. They're new. There's, you know, each state has different rules that you have to follow, and so we've been working with land trusts, you know, really on a national level to help more of them put these types of easements in place. Next week, I'm actually going to be traveling to Western Colorado. We're going to be having a training there with, you know, about 10 land trusts that are going to be in attendance. We had a training in California last year, in Sacramento. We had a training before that in Providence, Rhode Island. So there's growing interest across the country in this type of conservation easement because land trusts are concerned about what they're seeing, and they're also, you know, looking at, you know, the bigger problem in agriculture of so much land about to transition, and I think they really want to be a part of making sure that land is transitioning to working farmers. Here in New York State, we are actually on our farm right now working with Scenic Hudson as well as Equity Trust on putting this type of conservation easement on our own farm to make sure that, you know, all the work we're putting into making sure, you know, this is a working farm here at Hardy Roots Community Farm, our farm, that will be passed down to, you know, other generations of working farmers. That's the goal. So, you know,
that's really
right, right in the Hudson Valley. It's, you know, Scenic Hudson, Columbia Land Conservancy is working on some of these, Agricultural Stewardship Association, and all of those groups are also partnering with Equity Trust specifically on making, you know, the easements just right and, you know, in compliance with New York State law.
In terms of the working farm easement, I'm just thinking of, I don't know, if you do you have children that you hope to transfer your farm to someday?
Yeah, we have two little girls who are 2 and 4, so, you know, not for some time, but, if they want to farm, then, yes, absolutely. We would love to be able to transition the farm to them.
So how does that, in the working farm easement, there's an allowance for that the same way? As long as they're going to work the farm, it allows for that kind of family transfer.
Right. Honestly, it depends on who's writing the easement. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. So if, I mean, you're right. Sometimes, you know, a family member is considered a, you know, a qualified buyer of the land or owner of the land. And sometimes that is not part of the working farm easement. They also have to, you know, demonstrate that they will work the land.
Yeah.
So it just depends both on the land trust writing it and, you know, the farmer who signs it. You know, if they want, you know, their family member to be in there and, you know, that to be a qualified transfer, then, you know, they
write it into it.
Request that.
Yeah. Oh, great. So that's interesting. I haven't heard about these working farm easements, and I'm excited to learn more. So thanks for digging into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. One other thing, just transitioning a little bit, I want to highlight another report that the National Young Farmers Coalition has just put out. So in tangent with access to land in some areas of the country, access to water on top of access to land is a huge barrier. So there in the West, there's a lot of attention coming down to water scarcity for farmers. And like I've said, you've just issued a new report highlighting these challenges, and I was hoping that you could give us an overview.
Sure. It's interesting. When National Young Farmers Coalition got started, we were coming from things from a very, northeast, eastern perspective where, water is
falling from the sky.
Scarce, and, actually, as we've seen with, several extreme weather events, flooding can be a much greater challenge, than lack of water. But in the Southwest, in the arid West, and certainly, in a time of drought, water is a major concern for young people in agriculture. So, after, working with our Western members, we decided that, water was something that we, like we're engaging with land, as a key issue, water was something that we wanted to engage on as well. So we have an office based in Durango, Colorado, and our program lead there, Kate Greenberg, traveled all across the arid Southwest, surveying farmers and community members about water and how people are using water and their conservation measures and also just their top agricultural concerns. And actually, among the concerns, like ag concerns, including, access to capital, access to land, water emerged as, number one, among their concerns. Climate change also was a top concern, which was really interesting to us because that's not something that we had really talked to our farmer constituency about before. But, of course, it's on all of our minds, but it was interesting that that was such a priority. And we also found that most of our young people that we surveyed are already using really good conservation practices.
And what are some of the
conservation? About 94% of them. That's something like drip irrigation as opposed to flood irrigation. Some like technical fixes that help to conserve water, but actually the most popular way to conserve water is building soil and taking care of the soil and being able to hold more water in the soil as opposed to just conserving the water, making sure that the soil is doing its part as well. So that survey is then going to be used for our work on the Farm Bill and our work, across the West to essentially, talk to lawmakers about why it's so important to lift up the next generation of young farmers in the West that, are already, using great conservation practices that we want all farmers to use. But, those farmers are, facing the same challenges that we are out east with land access and access to capital and all the rest. But then they have this, additional, concern of access to water. We also found that the federal programs, like the conservation programs that are supposed to be helping those farmers that, can provide capital there with cost share are not reaching many of the young farmers in the West. So that's something that we're going to be looking into a lot more.
So just to back up for a minute, for those of us with the Northeast perspective who are used to the rain falling from the sky and having maybe farm ponds. So what, I mean, water rights are like a thing out west. Like you have, you know, a, like prioritized access to water. So what does that, can you maybe speak a little bit about that so we can picture it? Like I'm, you know, I'm used to farming in the Northeast and a lot of our listeners might be too. So what does that actually look like in terms of how you get access to water and some of the challenges to just getting the water?
Right. Well, you know, I maybe in another program, you should have Kate Greenberg on, who's our Western Program Director, to tell, to, she can, you know, talk at length on water law, which is actually one of the things in the survey that we found out that even the farmers in the West don't fully understand it. There's just a lot of misperceptions about, you know, how water is used, and water rights and all the rest, and you know that adds to confusion, and that actually adds to a lot of water being wasted. So I am definitely not an expert on this, but essentially, you know, we use wells and surface water on our farm. In the West, you know, of course, some people do have groundwater that they have access to. But not everyone, and of course, you know, we hear a lot of stories about in California how that, you know, groundwater levels are dropping lower and lower, and so fewer farmers have access to, you know, that type of water for irrigation purposes. But many farmers irrigate off of ditches in the West, and those ditches are diverted from, you know, tributaries of often the Colorado River. The Colorado River Basin is where many of our tractors and our farmers are located. And so there, you know, is someone who's in charge of the ditch, essentially a company, and, you know, they're individual managers, and, you know, they turn on the water, essentially, at a certain point in the year. So often you won't have water until, you know, such and such day, and then you'll receive your water. And there's a certain amount of water that you are allowed to have on your farm, and you know that's what you have the right to, or you know people, you know, pay for rights from other people, and that type of sort of trading also goes on. But one of the things that you know surfaced in this report is that you know it's some farmers think that they have to keep using you know the amount of water that they have the right to be able to keep you know that amount of water as their right. So they even if they don't need it, right?
Yeah.
So that's like one of the things that you know farmers don't fully understand, and we're trying also to see if you know more education or even if you know policy change at some point would be practical or possible or whatnot. We're trying to see like how we can engage on that end of things, but really just you know helping farmers who are in the situation who have limited access to water, you know, be able to use conservation practices that are make their farms you know economically viable as well.
Yeah, and it seems like on top of that, just tying it back into getting farmers on the land, it would seem like water would be an added expense to like when you're prioritizing buying your farmland. I'm just guessing that land with water rights or prioritized water rights or however much would probably be more expensive and adding another barrier to the cost of getting on the land.
Yes, that's something that we heard many times in our focus groups, that irrigated farmland was unaffordable to farmers.
Yeah.
So yes, I mean it's definitely makes land much more expensive in the region.
Yeah. Wow, I'm still wrapping my head around that again, coming from the Northeast, just not taking some things for granted.
It's a different world.
Well, if folks want to check out the new report on water rights or any of the other reports or the platforms that we've talked about here today, they can look up the National Young Farmers Coalition on the web at www.youngfarmers.org. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today and going over some of the great work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
And that's another episode of the Farm Report. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.